From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the heartfelt ballads and yodeling of country singer Don Walzer. He got his big break last year at the age of 60 when he retired from his government job and made his first commercially released album. He's been performing since the 50s, when he sometimes shared the bill with Buddy Holly in small Texas towns. Then we remember writer Stanley Elkin, who died Wednesday of a heart attack. Elkin's novels include The Dick Gibson Show and The Franchiser. Our interview was recorded in 1993. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Bridges of Madison County, starring Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Bosnian Serb troops are claiming that they have captured the American pilot whose plane was downed today over Serb-held territory in Bosnia. NATO Commander Admiral Leighton Smith says the alliance is checking the Serb claims. NATO officials say the F-16 fighter jet was hit by an anti-aircraft missile and the pilot ejected safely from the plane. The Serbs took 16 more French UN peacekeepers hostage today. French Prime Minister Alain Juppé says the French government supports the creation of a rapid reaction force in Bosnia. Lynn Terry reports.
Diplomats have indicated in the past few days that there might be a diplomatic breakthrough in the former Yugoslavia, but Prime Minister Alain Juppé poured cold water on that hope, saying that hardliners in the region are becoming more and more hardline. The contact group has pinned its hopes on Serbia's recognition of Bosnia in exchange for the suspension of sanctions and help in releasing the hostages. Juppé repeated that France could still pull out. In the meantime, the Prime Minister called on other countries to join a rapid reaction force in Bosnia. The force would open humanitarian corridors and help endangered peacekeepers. It will be discussed at a meeting in Paris on Saturday of NATO and European Union defense ministers. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Reuters is now quoting TV reports as saying 120 of the UN peacekeepers being held hostage have been released on orders of the Serbian president, but so far there have been no confirmation of that report. Medical researchers are warning that the overuse of antibiotics is leading to new drug-resistant strains of disease. At a child health forum in Vancouver, Dr. Samuel Katz of Duke University said the world is squandering the gift of antibiotics. He said the antibiotic-resistant diseases now rank alongside AIDS as the prime challenge facing the medical community. President Clinton has renewed China's most favored nation trade status for another year. UPI's Bill Small reports from the White House.
President Clinton has renewed preferential trading status for China, despite a human rights record that Press Secretary Mike McCurry calls unacceptable. In a written statement, McCurry says China continues to deny its citizens freedoms of speech, association, and religion, and fails to guarantee humane treatment of prisoners. Even so, McCurry says, the president feels that human rights issues and China's trading status should continue to be delinked on grounds that a broad engagement with China offers the best prospect for progress on issues of concern to the U.S. Some Republicans in Congress don't agree and have already said they'll introduce a resolution of disapproval when they return from recess next week. Bill Small at the White House.
Concern about a possible recession increased today in the face of two government reports. There was a surprising decline of 101,000 jobs on business payrolls last month, and in April, the index of leading economic indicators fell for the third straight month. This is NPR News. At the O.J. Simpson trial today, the Los Angeles County coroner acknowledged that mistakes were made in the autopsies of both Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. The prosecution has already conceded there were some errors, but maintains they did not affect the findings in the case. Next week, the jury is expected to be shown some of the color autopsy photos. Court-martial proceedings are underway in Oklahoma for the lone Air Force officer charged in last spring's friendly fire incident over northern Iraq. 26 people died when two U.S. jets shot down two Army helicopters. Jennifer Johnson of member station KOSU reports.
During opening arguments, prosecutors claim the deadly incident over Iraq last April could have been avoided if Air Force Captain Jim Wang had simply done his job. Wang was a senior officer aboard an AWACS radar plane monitoring the Iraqi no-fly zone when the deadly shoot-down occurred. Prosecutor Major Larry Dash says it was Wang's responsibility to supervise his crew members, maintain an accurate technical picture of the area, and to warn jet pilots that the helicopters they were firing at were friend, not foe. Defense attorneys argue Wang is not to blame, though. They say the AWACS unit did not order the attack, adding the shootdown was made only after the jet pilots made a visual ID of the helicopters. If found guilty of dereliction of duty, Captain Wang faces dismissal from the Air Force and a prison sentence. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Johnson in Stillwater, Oklahoma.
The driver who suffered a brain injury in a crash at the Indianapolis 500 on Sunday has regained consciousness. Stan Fox had been unconscious since his car slammed into a wall and exploded. Doctors say it's too early to know whether actor Christopher Reeve of Superman fame will ever walk again. He's been paralyzed since being thrown from a horse last weekend. He's scheduled to undergo surgery on Monday. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down just over 29 points at 4443.35. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Country music styles have come and gone. Don Walter says he's still singing the same way he did back in the 50s, when he sometimes shared the bill with the young Buddy Holly in small Texas towns. Walter has a gift for singing ballads and for yodeling, but he never made it commercially, so he kept his day job. He worked in the National Guard as a mechanic and administrator, then worked for the state. He retired last year when he turned 60. His retirement coincided with his first commercially released recording, Rolling Stone from Texas, on the Austin-based label Watermelon. He's lived in Austin since the late 80s, where he's developed a following among alternative rock fans as well as fans of classic country music. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Don Walter, recorded last December. Let's start with a song from his CD, Rolling Stone from Texas. It's a yodeling cowboy ballad called Cowpoke.
I'm lonesome, but I'm happy. Rich, but I'm broke. And the good Lord knows the reason. I'm just a cowpoke. From Dallas to Austin, the ranges I know. I drift with the wind. No one cares where I go.
Don Walser, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be talking with you today.
What happens to your voice when you yodel? How do you do it?
Well, it's kind of done down in your throat, and you hit a falsetto, and then you just come right back out of it to something else, you know. You know, like, you know, it sounds kind of dumb when you're doing it like that, but then if you speed it up, it's, you see what I'm saying?
Uh-huh. Well, you do an Eddie Arnold song on your new album, I'll Hold You in My Heart Till I Can Hold You in My Arms. And one of the things I love about your version of this song is that you don't yodel in the song, but you use that kind of falsetto yodel-like quality in the melody. You just, like, work it into the melody line.
Right. That was Ray Benson's idea. Him and T.J. McFarlane produced this CD, and he said, why don't you try a falsetto on the end of it and just do the melody? He'd heard me do it before on other songs, and so I have to blame that on him. That wasn't the way I usually sung it, but I'm glad that he came up with the idea, because I really enjoy it.
Well, this is I'll Hold You in My Heart from Don Walser's new album, Rolling Stone from Texas.
Been held before.
It's really a beautiful recording. Don Walser, I'd like to get back to your yodeling for a moment. Do you feel like you know different styles of yodeling, or is there just one style that's the Don Walser style?
Well, I think that I do a Jimmy Rogers type yodel. I think we put one. Yeah, we did. We put California Blues on there, and it's a different kind of yodel. But I sort of do a Swiss yodel, and I kind of patterned that after hearing the Jimmy Wakely song that Slim Whitman did back in the late 40s, I believe it was. I believe it was in the late 40s that he did Casting My Lasso. And I liked that Swiss yodel, and I started doing that more. And, of course, Elton Britt did some things like Cannonball Yodel and stuff like that got me to doing that.
What's the difference between a Swiss yodel and a cowboy yodel? And maybe you could demonstrate the difference for us.
Well, a cowboy yodel is sort of like, sort of like that, you know. And then a Swiss yodel is more like, you know, it's more of a double yodel than the cowboy yodel is. You know, like an old cowboy song. I remember I used to do one when I was growing up called Rainbow in the Rio Colorado, and it has a kind of different yodel to it, too. And I don't know, it's just I just sort of developed a lot of the yodels because I didn't have access out there where I grew up to anyone else's yodels, and I still haven't really paid much attention. I've been, you know, so busy throughout my life that I really hadn't bought and listened to other folks yodeling. I guess I need to do that, but I haven't.
Did you learn to do this before your voice changed or after?
You know, I don't think my voice changed a whole lot.
Really?
It may have gotten maybe even higher whenever I when it changed, because I believe that I can sing higher than I could when I was about 15 years old.
Huh.
And that's strange. I don't understand it, but that's kind of the way it's been. I know I used to sing some folk songs with a couple of girls, and they would always make me sing lower than I wanted to.
Take us back to your childhood a little bit. Would you describe for us where you grew up?
I grew up in a little farming community of La Mesa, Texas, right between Lubbock and Big Spring, out on the South Plains of Texas, a little strip of land right below the Panhandle. And my mother passed away when I was about not quite 12 years old. And in those days, the Lubbock County and up in there had a lot of cotton. And the old La Mesa Cotton Oil Mill was where my father worked, and he was the night superintendent. And back in those days, when the mill run, well, you had to be there all the time. So he worked from 6 in the afternoon, in the evening, until 6 in the morning, 7 days a week while the mill was running. And that usually was at least 6 to 8 months during the year, and sometimes even longer, according to the size of the crop.
So your mother died when you were 12. Your father mm-hmm. worked, 12 hours a day at the mill. Who took care of you?
Nobody. I just stayed at home. I would kind of, you know, when you're young like that, you see things that's not there, you know. So I kept the radio going all the time, you know. Even at night, I'd go to sleep with it. And if I woke up during the night, well, I'd listen to it a while. And it's always on one of those old border stations from down in Mexico or the Grand Ole Opry, and I just grew up on that old music, and I almost had a photographic memory, and I remembered most of those songs, and I still do remember most of them, and I never wanted to sing anything but those songs because they sort of helped me make it, you know, through life.
Is there a song that you found particularly comforting when you were home alone at night and a little afraid and you'd put on the radio?
Well, I liked the old heart songs and the ballads more than I did the boogie woogies and things like that. But I think, you know, back in those days, the B movies and the old radio programs that they had, they depicted life, I think, just a little bit better than what it is. And I think today the music we hear, a lot of it, and a lot of the movies that we see depict life a lot worse than what it really is, you know. And I think that's where I got most of my raising was from listening to those songs. I remember Eddie Arnold had a song out one time. It called "We're Rocking Alone in an Old Rocking Chair," and it was about a neglected grandmother. And after listening to that, I said, "Boy, I'll never let mine do that."
Can you sing a couple of lines of that?
Yeah, let me get my guitar here. Rocking alone in an old rocking chair, I spied an old mother with silvery hair. She seemed so neglected as I saw her there, rocking alone in an old rocking chair. Her hands were calloused, withered and old. A life of hard work was the story they told. And I thought of angels as I saw her there, rocking alone in an old rocking chair. It wouldn't take much to gladden her heart, just some small remembrance on somebody's part. A card or a letter would brighten life there, rocking alone in an old rocking chair. I know some kids in an orphan's home who'd think they owned heaven if she were their own. They'd never be glad to let her sit there, rocking alone in an old rocking chair.
Oh, that sounds great. Thank you so much for singing that for us. I think I can really understand why you alone without a mother would so relate to this song about a woman alone who is neglected.
Well, that's kind of the why I love these old songs, because and why I try to keep them alive.
So when did you get a guitar? I mean, your family was poor.
That's another story. There's a cousin of mine, J.R. Wright was his name. He married one of my cousins, and I used to get up in a tree, you know, when I'd come home from school. Even before Mother died, I would get up in that tree and sing, because I just had to sing, you know, every day. And I had to find a place and where I could do it, because I was kind of ashamed to do it in front of anybody. And I'd get up in the tree and sing. And sometimes I'd stay up there till after dark, and then I'd get down and come in the house after dark. But I remember that years later I would meet some of the folks from home, and they'd say, "Oh, you're the little guy that used to get up in the tree and sing." And I didn't realize they was even listening to me. And my kinfolks would always make me sing, and because they enjoyed what I sung. But they all said, "You need to learn how to play guitar." And J.R. Wright bought me an old Stella guitar way back when I was about 13 or 14 years old. And, of course, I didn't have a book to learn from, and I learned how to grip it like a club instead of pushing your hand out and playing it right, you know. But I learned. I went to a Tex Ritter movie and learned the C chord. I got to watching where his fingers were, and some guy down the street knew three or four chords, and I just sort of learned it from other people and watching them, and I really learned it the wrong way. If I'd have been able to, you know, afford a teacher or something, I've probably been. I'm still not a very good guitar player. I can just sort of get by.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Don Walser. He has a new CD called Rolling Stone from Texas. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. back with singer and guitarist Don Walser. Now, I know that where you grew up was not far from Lubbock.
That's
of course,
right.
Lubbock's big star was Buddy Holly. And I know now, that there were times you shared a bill with him, right?
Oh, yes. Of course, back then I didn't really know who he was, but there was a drive-in theater there in La Mesa, Texas that Skeet Nart had this old drive-in called a Skyview. And, in fact, it's still operating. It's one of the last ones that hadn't been closed down. And he had a ramp house where you could go sit in the wintertime and watch it instead of running your heater in your car, and you had seats that you could watch through the glass in the ramp house. Then he had a big projection room there and he had a little stage on top of it, and he would bring in guys like Hoyle Nix and Buddy Holly, and I would always play with them. You know, each time I would play some, and they'd have a new recording guy, you know, somebody that would come out with a new hit song and that lived in that part of the country, and they would have them come down and play at the Skyview during between the movies, you know, and I would share bills with them. And then also one of his Buddy Holly's first, I don't know if he's a manager or just worked with him, his name was High Pockets Duncan. And I don't know his real name, but he was a disc jockey on KDAV there in Lubbock, and I didn't have a telephone, and he would, he'd get in touch with me. He'd say, well, some of you folks over there in La Mesa, they called me Donnie back then, said, tell old Donnie Walser that I want him to be at such and such place at such and such a time, and that's the way I'd get word. Someone would hear it, and they'd come tell me, High Pockets wants you to be so in a certain place, you know, and that's kind of the way I found out. In a way, I did share bills with lots of people. And back then, he was just a tall, Buddy Holly was just a tall boy with glasses, and I didn't really realize who he was until many years later.
Did rock and roll make it hard for you to do your music?
Yeah, it put a bunch of us almost out of business there for a while when Elvis and some of those guys came in. And it was good music, and I even did a little of it myself, but it never was, my heart never was there, you know, so just kept doing plugging away at what I do now, you know.
Which Elvis songs did you do?
Oh, Heartbreak Hotel and some of those, three or four of them, just enough to satisfy some of the young girls that was in the crowd.
do a couple of bars of Heartbreak Hotel the way you do
boy.
It.
I don't even know if I can do it anymore. It's been so many years. Let's see. I don't even I gotta find the right key here. Well, since my baby left me, I found a new place to dwell. Down at the end of Lonely Street, Heartbreak Hotel, I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely. I get so lonely, I could die. That's not very good, but
that's great. So there was a period when you felt like Elvis and other rock and rollers were starting to put you out of business. What did you do?
Well, we just kept playing. We would do a few of those songs. And I love Chuck Berry. We used to do a lot of Chuck Berry songs. And not a lot of them, but a few enough to get us through the night, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, I think that old rock and roll music was great music. And I still love to hear it. We got a group here in Austin called the High Noon Boys that do that stuff. They even made a 78 RPM record not too long ago using the old tube stuff that they used to record with back in those days.
Are you a grandfather now?
Oh, yes. I have 5 grandchildren.
So what's it like for you now to be singing all these songs to probably bigger audiences and broader audiences than ever, and to be a grandfather at the same time?
Oh, it's great. I get to bring my grandkids out sometimes that we play a couple of places we play down that regularly because we want to be in some place regularly, and we play like in Babe's on 6th Street every Monday and then little Mexican restaurant called Jovita's down on South 1st Street here in Austin. And I always can bring my grandkids there and they can listen to the music and enjoy themselves. And it's good.
Did you ever want to be the young singer who was really good looking and all the girls fell for, and, you know, to become a big, like, romantic hero as well as a singer?
I think all of us did that going. I had the star syndrome there for a couple of years until I realized that I was having more fun than the stars were, you know. I was getting to play for weddings and old VFW halls and getting right there with the people, and I didn't have to worry about Carnegie Hall or any of those places. But I did have to take my wife. I told her when we married, I said, I'm in the National Guard, and I'll stay there till I retire, and I'm going to be gone some each year to go to summer camp. And I said, I'm going to play my music all my life, and so you got to get used to that. And if you don't trust me, then you've got to go with me. And I sort of insisted when we were young that she'd go with me, and so she could see that I was straight. You know what I mean? But I wasn't a bad looking old boy when I was younger, and had a few pounds off of me. And I did have a few of them try to chase me, but they always was afraid of my wife. You know how that goes.
So she did travel with you through the years?
Oh, yeah, she went everywhere I went back in those days. Now she doesn't go to every place. She comes out to a couple of places and helps me sell what products we have and so forth. But she trusts me now after all these years. And she says I'm like an old dog chasing a car anyway. If a dog caught the car, he couldn't drive it anyway.
Don Walser, it's just been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much. For being on the show.
Thank you, too. And we appreciate the privilege we have of being able to do this sort of thing. And I hope that the people will go back out and not just buy our stuff, but get the folks that do the old traditional stuff and listen to those great old songs.
Don Walser recorded last December. His CD is called Rolling Stone from Texas, and it's on Watermelon Records. This weekend, Don Walser plays the Summer Lights Festival in Nashville. In July, two CDs of his archive recordings will be released by Watermelon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I got my angel on my mind. That's why I'm walking. I've got an ache in this old heart, and I'm not talking. Little hands that held me tight, just to wave goodbye tonight. I got a sweet love on my mind, that's why I'm
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we remember novelist Stanley Elkin. He was once described as an ingenious genius of language, laughter, and the irresistible American idiom. Elkin died Wednesday of a heart attack at the age of 65. He had multiple sclerosis for over 20 years. We'll listen back to a 1993 interview with him. And the best-selling novel, The Bridges of Madison County, has been made into a movie starring Clint Eastwood, who also directed it. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The leader of the Bosnian Serbs is defending the downing today of a U.S. fighter jet, saying NATO has no right to fly over the skies of Serb-held territory. The pilot of the F-16 parachuted to the ground. Serb forces claim they have captured him, but NATO officials have not confirmed that. President Clinton reacted to the downing of the jet.
I want to reiterate and make absolutely clear that our policy on Bosnia remains firm. For reasons that I think are obvious, I will have no further comments on the situation today.
NATO search crews are still looking for the pilot. There are reports now that 126 of the UN peacekeepers being held hostage may have been released today by the Serbs, but so far no confirmation. 16 additional French peacekeepers were taken hostage by the Serbs north of Sarajevo. Defense Secretary William Perry and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General John Shalikashvili will meet in Paris with their European allies tomorrow. The two men expected to offer American military support for the embattled UN peacekeeping force. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
In a prepared statement released by his Capitol Hill office, House Republican Floyd Spence of South Carolina, chairman of the House National Security Committee, describes the downing of a U.S. F-16 over Bosnia-Herzegovina as a tragic reminder of the risks and dangers associated with deepening American involvement in the Balkan conflict. Spence has scheduled a committee hearing for Thursday to delve into the Clinton administration's Bosnia policy and the possible deployment of U.S. troops to the area. In his statement, Spence expresses his sympathy to the pilot and his family and says the incident only strengthens his determination to press the administration for a full accounting of its policy. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
The nation's unemployment rate eased back a bit last month to 5.7%, but a separate survey found that the number of jobs dropped by 101,000, the steepest decline in over 4 years. Analysts had been expecting business payrolls to rise. In another sign the economy is losing steam, the Commerce Department reported that its index of leading economic indicators fell in April by 0.6%, the third straight monthly decline and the biggest in 2 years. Analyst David Weiss says the new numbers suggest our economy may be heading for a hard landing.
This is an indication not only is the economy slowing down, but it may be heading to a harder landing than we thought it was going to be. Certainly the risk of a recession has risen after this report. I still feel we're on track for a soft landing, but boy, this number makes me nervous.
The latest economic statistics from the government were enough to prompt a bank in St. Louis to lower its prime rate by 0.5 percentage point, but so far, major banks have not followed suit. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 28 points to close at 4444.39 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Clinton administration is proposing an expansive transatlantic free trade zone to encourage new trade with the European continent and expand job and investment opportunities. The concept could also soften the impact of the restrictive trade practices of Japan and other Asian countries. The U.S. and Japan appear ready to resume their negotiations in an effort to defuse their trade dispute over cars and auto parts. The U.S. ambassador to Japan, Walter Mondale, met with Japan's trade minister today. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Ambassador Mondale proposed that bilateral talks on autos be resumed again in Geneva on June 12th. Until today, Washington had rebuffed Japanese pleas for urgent negotiations. While the U.S. Embassy refused to characterize the new receptive U.S. attitude, it does represent a small step toward accommodating complaints by Asian and European trading partners. Along with Japan, they view Washington's planned 100% import duties on Japanese luxury cars illegal. The June June 12th date falls before the G7 Halifax summit and allows both sides the chance to avoid having the trade dispute overshadow the meeting of the world's seven wealthiest industrialized nations. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Radio talk show host Sonny Block has been arrested by police in the Dominican Republic and will be returned to the U.S. to face criminal charges. Block is accused of bilking his listeners out of $21 million by luring them into investment scams. His financial advice show was heard on nearly 150 radio stations nationwide. A new study finds that men tend to be more long-winded than women, and they're more likely to interrupt conversations. The researchers at the University of Dayton found that women tend to be more considerate and yielding to others in conversations, and they tend to offer more encouraging remarks. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Writer Stanley Elkin died Wednesday at the age of 65 of heart failure. In an obituary in today's New York Times, William Grimes wrote, quote, "Elkin was often described as a clear-eyed realist, even though his work veered toward parody and black humor. His deliberately preposterous fictional situations led him to explore the pain at the heart of the human condition. His long struggle with multiple sclerosis only deepened his preoccupation with suffering and mortality," unquote. Elkin had MS since 1972 and needed a wheelchair to get around. His best-known novels include The Dick Gibson Show, about a radio talk show host, and The Franchisor, the story of a businessman with a chain of ice cream stores who develops MS. Elkin's other books include The MacGuffin, George Mills, and Pieces of Soap. I spoke with Elkin in 1993, after the publication of Van Gogh's Room at Arles, three novellas. The first novella was about a professor of political geography who has multiple sclerosis. Just as he's preparing for a party he's throwing for his graduate students, his wife walks out on him. I asked Elkin if this was him imagining the worst.
It's partially me imagining the worst, and it's actually something that really happened. I mean, my wife did not leave, but I was teaching at Boston University in the fall of 1976, and my MS was just beginning to kick in rather severely. And there was a snowstorm. I had been invited out to some student's house for dinner, and they were troubled by the snowfall, and so they asked if they could come and bring the dinner to my place. Now, this was somewhat awkward for me because I made it a habit never to keep anything in my refrigerator. I ate every meal out at this Greeky Spoon on Kenmore Square, and they insisted on coming, and I told them, but you must be very, very careful to clean up everything, because I never touched the house. I mean, I lived in one room, essentially, and wouldn't have recognized the kitchen if I had been pushed into it. At any rate, they did come, and they were, you know, seven sheets to the wind when they arrived, and 114 to the wind when they left. I mean, and it just became a disaster. And I did command them to stay and do as they promised, to clean up everything, and of course they didn't, and it was just totally out of control. My wife and family were not with me at that time. They were back in St. Louis living the life. And when I wrote this novella some many years later, I called on those circumstances.
I'm interested in how you think your writing has been changed, if at all, by the MS. Do you think it's changed stylistically at all?
No, I don't think it's changed stylistically. I think I'm able to concentrate more because the only thing I can do is sit in a chair.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I open the store in the morning, the bubble machine, the word processor, and sit down, and before I know it, day is done. Playing taps. So in the days when I could, you know, smoke and walk around and hop and skip and play ping pong, that was always a lot more fun than writing, and so I did it. Today, you know, I do my work.
I interviewed Andre Debuse
not too long ago, and he is paralyzed from the waist down.
I know that.
Yeah, because of a car accident that he was in. And he was telling me that he was having such a hard time writing, and he was trying to write about, you know, able-bodied people, and he was spending all this time.
That's because I know why that is. It's because his thing came on so abruptly.
Right. Well, what he told me was that he didn't want to write about somebody. He didn't want to write fiction about somebody who was in a wheelchair, because he felt that until he could write about somebody who could get up and walk around, and that he wasn't really writing yet. Did you ever go through a crisis like that?
No, not really. I mean, when the MS was diagnosed in England in 1972, I went into a kind of clinical depression almost, but I lay in my bed and read The Drapes, and finally Joan said, let's go to the movies. We went to the movies, and that was the end of it.
How long did the depression last?
Maybe 2 weeks.
How was it diagnosed?
Oh, I began with a kind of numbness in my fingers, which I thought at the time, you know, was just from bad posture or something. And they sent me to a gym, and the numbness in my right finger spread to a general numbness in my left hand. And then they put me in the hospital and gave me this spinal tap and said, it's MS, kiddo. And I didn't know what MS was, and it scared the hell out of me. And I thought, you know, I would be falling downstairs. But that didn't happen. And that's what I mean by what happened to Andre Dubuque. I mean, his came on, you know, so suddenly. Mine, you know, you can get accustomed to anything.
Uh-huh.
And so from 72 to 75, I had this tingling. I didn't start using a cane until 76, and then you know, it's only been a few years since I've been in a wheelchair, and, you know, I can hardly remember the good old days.
We're featuring a 1993 interview with writer Stanley Elkin, who died Wednesday. More of our interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with our 1993 interview with Stanley Elkin. I want to ask you a little bit about growing up. Your father was a salesman for, I believe, costume jewelry?
Right, a firm called Coro.
So did he have to travel around and sell it? Was he a traveling salesman?
He was a traveling salesman, and he was away for perhaps 2 and 3 weeks at a time.
Uh-huh.
I guess... Then he would come home on weekends, and I saw him, you know, half my life.
And the other half he was gone?
Right.
Was he a good salesman?
He was a wonderful salesman.
Did he have a good rap?
Well, I mean, he didn't have a rap, because a rap is something you memorize. And my father was a very spontaneous man, and I never heard him repeat a story.
Did that
influence me?
Well, I was wondering if it helped inspire your interest in language.
It helped inspire my interest in story.
Uh-huh.
Because he always came back with wonderful tales of odd things that had happened to him on the road. And, I mean, he was an incredibly vivid man.
Did you read and write a lot when you were young?
I did more writing than reading. I mean, I never read a book until I was in high school. No, that's not true. I read See Here, Private Hargrove when I was 12 years old. And I read A Tree Grows in Brooklyn when I was, I think, 14. But that's it.
That's very unusual, isn't it, for someone to write a lot yet not read a lot?
Yes. I have no memory of being in high school, even. I mean, I remember Nothing ever happened to me in terms of the intellectual until I went to college. And then suddenly the world lit up for me.
What changed?
They gave you assignments. That's what changed. Now, they gave you assignments in high school and in grammar school, too, I suppose. But one didn't really do them. One was out in the schoolyard.
So what were you writing about during those earlier years?
Oh, they were such dopey things. I remember that I wrote a story. I was perhaps 12 or 13 years old, and it was about some guy. I remember he was reading addresses, 7243, 7246, 7247, and finally he comes to the address that he's going, and he goes in and he kills somebody. I mean, it was just a dopey story.
Why did you want to write?
The answer is going to be so mysterious, and I mean, I've never been to a psychiatrist in my life, but my father had, we've already mentioned that he worked for Coro, and he had all of this stationery with the Coro Pegasus, which was the logo for the firm, and I enjoyed just writing on that letterhead with the Pegasus, and it seemed to me that I was making a kind of book. I mean, it's just, who knows? Who? I can't explain that.
So there's almost something physical that you liked about writing.
It was something
visual.
It was a kind of production, just to see. I mean, if it had been on, I wouldn't have done it on plain paper.
Uh-huh. So you used to write all your stories on your father's stationery?
That's right. And then until I became ill, I used to write all my novels in university blue books, exam booklets.
And when you became ill, you started using a computer.
Right.
So, okay, you got to college, you started reading more. What did reading do for you? What did you find in books?
Style, language, the sense that, you know, one could say things that were, you know, just, if you've made a metaphor in a kind of way, you've found a thing. You've put something in the world that was never there before. It's as though you discovered grapes.
So when you started reading, did you find ideas that you thought but never expressed before, or people like you, or something that you deeply identified with?
No.
It was just about style.
Right. And in a kind of way, that's unfortunate, because to a certain extent, the rap on me is that, I'm all style and not a whole hell of a lot of plot. I don't think that's true as much as it used to be. I think that I discovered the idea of plot in combination with style with a novel I wrote, and it was published in 1982, called George Mills. And I think I've been able to do it ever since.
Some of my favorite writing of yours is essays in which you write about yourself and what you're thinking or what you're feeling. You had a recent essay about a period of temporary madness that you went through that was actually drug-induced by a drug that you were taking for the MS. Did you know when...
Well, I named the drug. It was prednisone.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very dangerous thing.
Did you know when you were going through this period of temporary madness that there was something wrong, or did you accept that reality as being reality?
Absolutely not. I thought, you know, I didn't know I was nuts until I was sitting in the shower and didn't know what I was supposed to be doing there. I had forgotten how to use soap. I had forgotten what water was for. And my wife Joan had to, put me through the paces of my shower. And I asked, how long has this been going on? She said, it's been going on for 2 or 3 weeks. And it was astonishing to me, because I thought that for 2 or 3 weeks, I'd been doing what I always did. I was working. And she said that, no, I hadn't been working. I'd been sitting on the side of the bed watching television, not even watching television, but just using the remote control and snapping from one station to the next. And this was directly attributable to the fact that I was on this, I was ODing on prednisone.
You were prescribed too large an amount?
I was prescribed the right amount, but you're supposed to taper off when you're taking prednisone, and the physical benefits of the drug are so astonishingly successful that I would not taper off, and I just kept feeding this stuff to myself.
Can you just describe a little bit what it was like, if you remember, to not know what water was for, to not know what soap was for?
It was, in a way, the most interesting. I mean, when I learned that I was nuts, I obsessed on it. It was the most interesting thing that had ever happened to me. I mean, I can't even say that I was depressed. I was depressed when I was told that I had multiple sclerosis. I was not depressed when I was told that I had to be hospitalized. And this only lasted, I was in the hospital for 5 days, but the whole period of my madness was perhaps 2 months.
So what was fascinating about being that disoriented and not recognizing anything?
Well, I'm a person who, concentrates on the world. And here I was concentrating on something that, had nothing at all to do with the world. I mean, I was having hallucinations, and it was just, it was very strange, very strange.
Stanley Elkin recorded in 1993. He died Wednesday at the age of 65. Elkin recently completed a novel called Mrs. Ted Bliss, which is scheduled to be published by Hyperion in September. This is Fresh Air. Here's a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. An American F-16 fighter jet flying a mission for NATO was shot down near Banja Luka in Bosnia. We'll hear from Andy Bowers in Sarajevo and Tim Judah at Serb headquarters in Pale. John Itzty reports that unemployment is rising in the U.S. Robert Siegel talks with Nora Bustani of The Washington Post about the anti-government riots that are reported to have taken place in Iraq. And Bob Garfield on worms and the chances of getting rich quick in the earthworm business. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Clint Eastwood has directed 17 movies, one of which, Unforgiven, won the Academy Award for Best Picture of 1992. His latest movie as actor-director is an adaptation of one of the biggest bestsellers ever published. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Bridges of Madison County.
It's hard to make a really good movie from a really good book. No film version of, say, Light in August or Rabbit at Rest, let alone War and Peace, is ever going to touch the hem of the novel it comes from. But cinematic silk purses can often be made from literary sow's ears. The Godfather movies are a perfect example. And now there's The Bridges of Madison County. I can't say that Clint Eastwood and his superb screenwriter Richard LaGravenese have made a movie for the ages, but they have made a genuinely absorbing, poignant, and believable romance out of the silliest piece of literary claptrap since Jonathan Livingston Seagull. The story's basically a pickup truck version of Brief Encounter. Francesca Johnson, a middle-aged, Italian-born Iowa farm wife, has 4 days to herself while her husband and kids are away at the state fair. Along comes Robert Kincaid, a photographer several years her senior. He's in the area to shoot some covered bridges for National Geographic. He's also, according to the book, a big-time love god. The author Robert James Waller spends page after page extolling his hardness, his poetic sense of life and love, his way of uttering sweet little nothings like, "I am the highway and a peregrine and all the sails that ever went to sea." Fortunately, Eastwood and La Gravenace have cut away all those wet sails and peregrines to leave a screenplay that's admirably terse and sometimes really charming, mainly due to the interplay that builds between the two main characters, Meryl Streep as Francesca and Eastwood himself as Robert. Here they are on the verge of drifting into an affair that will last 4 days, but, of course, be remembered for a lifetime.
I was just picking you some flowers.
Oh?
Men still do that, don't they? I'm not out of date, am I? I've been picking flowers for a woman, a sign of appreciation.
No, not at all. Except those are poisonous. I'm kidding. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding. I never... I'm so sorry.
Well, are you sadistic by nature or what?
No. I don't know why I did that. Very beautiful. Sorry.
It sounds strange to say that Clint Eastwood is one of the best-kept secrets in Hollywood, but he's almost never been used as a pure romantic lead, and that's a pity. He's just turned 65, and yet there's no more authentic heartthrob in the movies. The way Eastwood walks and gestures has a courtly elegance, and when he looks at Meryl Streep with the same intense squint that he once used to stare down gunslingers and street punks, well, you can believe that this is a seriously passionate man. He's made Robert Kincaid much more modest than in the book. This Kincaid doesn't pretend to be a great artist or to know all the world's dark secrets. He's self-effacing and even naive, and that only adds to his allure. Meryl Streep has put on some pounds and a lightly inflected Italian accent to play Francesca, and her performance is a beauty. Streep conveys a reticent woman who's quietly overcome with desire, and the whole movie can be read as her silent conversation with herself about what to do about it. Eastwood's pacing is slow and almost grave, and though the framing plot about Francesca's children finding her journals many years later doesn't work, the gradual build of the central romance really does. By the end, the grand passion of these two not very grand people becomes enveloping. The whole thing makes you wonder, if Eastwood can do this with The Bridges of Madison County, what could he do with, say, In the Kitchen with Rosie?
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl and directed by Alan Tu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, what it's like when your mother forgets she's related to you. We talk with Deborah Hoffman about her new documentary, Complaints of a Dutiful Daughter, a video journal about her relationship with her mother, who has Alzheimer's disease. The film was nominated for an Academy Award and will be shown Tuesday on PBS. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.